lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual Kwanis Hayes Annual Anniversary on Saturday, February 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the former DMV on 82nd Avenue in Portland. This is a candlelight vigil in loving memory of loved one Kwanis Hayes. This event is for the family and friends to remember Moose. On February 9th, 2017, Moose was shot 3 times by police. He was only 17 years old. Bring flowers, candles, and balloons, and stories to the now-closed DMV office near the Banfield Pet Hospital on Northeast 82nd. Again, that's the second annual Kwanis Hayes Angelversary on Saturday, February 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the former Oregon DMV building, 1836 Northeast 82nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6:30. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Prison Pipeline.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening and welcome to Prison Pipeline. My name is Emma Lugo and I'm a co-host of Prison Pipeline here. We are talking tonight with Mary Nord-Cavelli. Mary, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Oh, wonderful. Mary is a volunteer who visits people on death row here in the United States. And we're going to be talking tonight about Mary's and her sister Jean's unique experience traveling around the United States to different death row facilities and visiting people who are on death row. But let's just get started right away by jumping right into your story, Mary. Tell us, Mary, a little bit about how did you learn about death row visitation in the United States?
Well, it started off with a program on television in 1993, where a program that my sister, she watched and I watched at the same, well, we didn't know we were watching it, but it was about a retired school teacher who was writing to a young black man on death row in America who later got executed. And at the end of the program, it asked for anyone who wanted to write to a prisoner on death row to get in touch with Lifelines, which I did, and my sister, unbeknownst to me, also got in touch. And she was given David Miller as her pen pal.
And as that was her first pen pal.
It was her first pen pal.
Oh.
And as I was waiting for a pen pal, I asked if he could find someone for me to write to, and he said that I could write to him as well, and that's how it started, really. Oh.
So David Miller is a man who sat on death row in Tennessee at Tennessee's River Bend facility for 34 years. He was executed on December 16th of this past year after sitting on death row for 34 years. And he had been physically and emotionally abused as a child. And he also suffered from mental illness, which were mitigating factors in the commission of his crime. Mary and Jean had a unique 25-year relationship with David, where they came over from the United Kingdom every year for 25 years, visiting David as well as visiting other people on death row. And we're really honored tonight to have you here on Prison Pipeline. Mary, you're actually talking to us from, are you in London?
I am in London, yes.
Yeah, and it's 2:30 in the morning there.
2:30 in the morning, yes.
Thank you so much for talking to us. Let's talk a little bit about David to start the program. David was 61 years old when he was executed last month, and I know that you had a long relationship with him. So tell us a little bit about David as a person.
Well, we didn't actually know anything about his mental illness because when we first started writing to him, we could do tapes and he could send music and speak on the tapes, and he would talk about his relationship with his grandfather, which seemed to be very good. He never spoke about the rest of his family, and we would give him, we'd leave the tape running. I would go and visit my daughter and grandchildren, and they would also send letters to David. So it was like he became part of the family, really.
So when you first started communicating with David, it was through correspondence and through audio tapes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. When did you first meet David?
Well, a year later, I suggested, why don't we go and visit? And my sister took me up on that. Because I think it's quite a different relationship when you actually meet someone face to face than writing letters. I always like to meet people and see where they are.
So this was about 24 years ago you first met David?
Well, 1994. We started because in Tennessee, which is quite good, there is a guest house where people can stay for free who are visiting at the prisons there. So that was a great help because we didn't have to pay for hotels when we went over to visit.
I know that at some of the other death rows, the only options are to stay in hotels,
and
some of them, the places where you can stay are actually very, very far away from the prison.
Yes. I mean, some are in the middle of nowhere.
Right. Like Texas.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I have been there, but mm-hmm. It wasn't easy, especially as I don't drive a car, so... I needed to have people helping me to get there and back.
So when you first saw this program on the BBC about writing to people on death row, did you imagine that this was going to become such an important part of your life? I mean, coming to the U.S. and visiting? Mm-hmm.
No, we didn't. And I have to say that how Lifeline started was because of a BBC documentary called 14 Days in May, which came out in 1987, and it was the run-up to an execution of Edward Earl Johnson, who the warden felt was actually an innocent man, and he resigned. Don Cabana, who is the warden, he resigned afterwards because he killed an innocent man. And this program had such an effect on Jan Arians, who's a Quaker, because there was another prisoner on the program called Sam Johnson, and he had said, "We're all dying tonight." And Jan Arians started writing to Sam Johnson, and that's how Lifelines began in 1987. And it 1988, actually, because the 30th anniversary was last year.
I know that when an execution happens, it's an incredibly traumatic experience for everyone in the prison.
Yes.
And whenever there's an execution, everyone in the prison is put on lockdown, usually for at least an entire day before and after the execution, because the people who run prisons understand what an incredibly traumatic effect this has on everyone who's incarcerated.
It must have an effect on the prison guards as well, mm-hmm. I would think.
as well as people who, you know, love and care about these people. So we ran into each other before David's execution. We've met before, but I ran into you and Jean before David's execution. And did you actually go to his execution?
No, he didn't want us to be there. He'd said that many years ago, that he didn't want us. We would have if he'd asked us to.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't what he wanted.
Were you surprised to hear that he was actually going to be executed after 34 years?
Well, it was such a long time. He had had a execution date in 2015, and we went over to see him, and he had a stay then. But this year, last year, 2018, they seemed to start executing people in Tennessee much more, and they've got a whole list of people that they're intending to execute in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, the fact that it actually was happening, you know, it's always a shock when someone dies.
Is David the first person that you visited on death row who's been executed, or have you gotten to know other people who were also murdered by the state?
He's the first person that I visited who was executed. I did used to write to a man in Florida, Mark Schwab, who was executed. He was my first pen friend who was executed. And I used to be in contact with his mom as well. He was very fortunate that his mom was a regular visitor. And his last letter to me said, "Oh, can you make sure my mom's all right, you know, because she's the light of my life." And it was quite a moving letter. I actually read it out at a Lifelines conference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do they have Lifelines in the United States, or is that specifically based in the UK?
It's specifically based in the UK, but we do have speakers come over from the United States, people who have been released, exonerated from prison.
Mm-hmm.
We have, like, Brian Stevenson, who's a wonderful lawyer. We have Helen Prejean.
Helen Prejean, yes, Sister Helen.
We've had Sunny Jacobs, who she was on Florida death row and released after 16 years, who's quite amazing. Because there's a play called The Exonerated,
mm-hmm.
Which is about five different people and their words saying about their stories, which is quite moving.
Mm-hmm. So what is the attitude in Great Britain towards execution? Is it practiced in Great Britain?
I was looking this up. The death penalty was abolished in Great Britain in 1965.
Mm. Okay.
So
nobody on death row to visit in Great Britain.
Did I guess?
Nobody to visit on death row in Great Britain.
No. I can still visit people in prison, but not...
Whereas
on death row.
In the United States, you have, I think, about 7,000, no, not quite that many, maybe about 4,000 people you could potentially visit on death row in the United States.
Yeah, mm-hmm. There's certainly thousands in the United States.
Can you tell me, Mary, what is involved in becoming a visitor for someone who's on death row? What is the process like? How do you do it?
Well, there is a different process in each prison. Like, take, for example, San Quentin. I would write 3 months beforehand to the visiting sergeant asking if I could have a visit. And then if it was approved, that the prisoner who I was going to visit would get information saying, this is when you're going to get your visit and the time of the visit. And then they would let me know this is when our visit is. Other prisons, like Texas, you have to do it a specific time, like the month before, on a specific day. You phone up and ask, and that can be quite harrowing, really, because you can be on hold for a long time trying to get through because other people are trying to get through to schedule their visits. So it's different.
And it just
I mean, Chowchilla, the women's prison in California was the most difficult to actually get into because I had to have a check done on myself to make sure I wasn't a criminal, mm-hmm. and I had to send a copy of my passport, and then of course they have to approve it or not approve it. It's up to the authorities there.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been turned down for visitation?
No, I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
You have to wear the right clothes mm-hmm. to be, like, for example, in San Quentin, you can't wear certain colors. And I was actually standing in behind someone who was wearing black trousers with gray stitching, who was refused because gray is not allowed, but black is. And I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't been standing there. But now, outside of San Quentin, there's a house where people can go and get clothes to wear that are actually, you know, approved for visitation.
Oh, that's great. San Quentin is just such an amazing... I mean, for a prison, for a U.S. prison, San Quentin is really impressive. San Quentin does a... they have a newspaper that they've published that's written by prisoners, by insiders. It's been published for, I think, almost 30 years. San Quentin is also the only prison in the United States where you can still get a college degree for free. And, you know, it's amazing how in the United States, we don't value higher education for people who are incarcerated, thinking that... you know, apparently not thinking about what people are going to do when they get out of prison, and also not valuing the incredible value of education for people who are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, we do offer some GED programs for people who are incarcerated, but in the 1980s, we eliminated almost all free college education for people who are incarcerated. You know, I'm not sure what reason. I think it was to punish them, which is completely counterproductive. So I want to ask some more questions about David and also about visiting people on death row, because it's a unique avocation. Not a lot of people are willing to do what you and your sister do. So can you tell me, when you were friends with David over the 25 years that you were visiting him, did he get a lot of visitors?
No, he got very few visitors. His daughter, Stephanie, who lives in Ohio, came a few times to see him. And quite luckily, he had a volunteer, Heather. She used to come from 1997. She was his volunteer until she got married and then had children. And then she didn't visit quite so often. But nearer the end, we met her when we were over in November. We had met her previously. She wanted to be his spiritual advisor, and he wanted her to be his spiritual advisor, but it was denied. But she was able to see him the day before he was executed. So we kept in touch.
Mm-hmm.
And these were actually the only visitors. From 2015, which when me and Jean visited, until last year in March when I went on my own, it was the same page. Like, you could see who had visited him because I had to sign this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see that when his last visit was, and it was like months and months and months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So he had very few visitors. He had no family except his daughter to visit. I mean, he had loads of sisters, but none of them. I mean, one of them wanted to be my friend on Facebook, and she said, "Oh, how is he?" And when I told him, he said to me, "Well, she hasn't written to me for 20 years, but mm-hmm. she's asking me, 'Oh, how is he?'"
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think people don't understand about people who are on death row is that almost everyone who's on death row, if you ask anyone who does mitigation, which is the process that people go through when they're trying to appeal a death penalty sentence, they have mitigation investigators who look at a person's background and their history. And to a person, almost every single person who is on death row had some incredibly traumatic experience in their childhood. They were victims of sexual abuse. They were victims of physical abuse. Many of the people on death row are only marginally mentally competent to even be standing for trial. And, you know, the United States is one of the cruelest countries in the world when it comes to the application of the death penalty. And it's people who are on death row are incredibly lonely and suffering. And, you know, having people like you and your sister Jean come and visit them is, you know, a real act of compassion, which I really admire. And I'm really glad to have you on the show tonight talking about this. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Prison Pipeline. We've got about 10 minutes left in the program today, and we're talking with Mary Nordkavelli. Mary is a resident of the United Kingdom, and she and her sister Jean have been traveling to the United States for 25 years, visiting people on death row in the U.S. During their vacation. This is just what you do for your vacation. Is that right, Mary?
Yes, that's correct. But we make such good friends wherever we go. We meet people who have the same kinds of values.
Mm-hmm. I mean, are you and your sister like incredibly independently wealthy? Is that how you're able to?
No.
You just do this as your vacation. This is what you do.
Yeah, we used to go twice a year when mm-hmm. we were working, but now that we've retired, you know, it's once a year. But we write lots of letters, because a letter can make a big difference as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a window into a different world.
Yeah.
People are so interested as well in London for some reason, in the British Isles. I mean, a lot of prisoners know more about what's going on here, because my sister also writes to someone in Nevada, and he can tell her things about what's going on mm-hmm. here more than she does, because she doesn't watch the news, but he's really interested. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What do people in Great Britain think about the United States justice system? Do you ever talk to people about it?
Well, they think it's very backward.
Mm-hmm.
That it's, you know, compared with China because of having a death row. It's just an anomaly, really. You know, mm-hmm. it's supposed to be the land of the free. This is how it's portrayed. But its justice system leaves a lot to be desired. And it's good that there's other people like Sister Helen who's, you know, doing her best to
raise
help.
Awareness. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the case of David, he was guilty of the crime that he committed.
Yes, yes.
And
we knew.
We never
asked him what he'd done. We never ask anyone what they've done. It's up to them whether they want to tell you or not. And we knew that he had murdered a woman. That was all. And in those days, people nowadays can look on the internet and find out what someone's done, which can be, it can put some people off, I think, nowadays, because there's so much information. But we would never, ever betray a trust, really,
mm-hmm.
because we were meeting him as a person. And he, you know, he was humorous. He gave us really strong hugs when he met us. Like last time in November, like if we coughed, he would produce a cough sweet of his sock, actually. Of course. He would always bring us coffee because there's no hot drinks in the machines in the prison.
Mm.
And we enjoy our coffee, and then, you know, you, in the visiting room there was water and a microwave, so we could make coffee. And he just showed care to us all the time.
So he
was very moving.
Mm-hmm. And he was really glad to see you.
Oh, yes. He mm-hmm. was always glad to see us.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't convey much of his feelings, but he always said he was glad to see us, which mm-hmm. made all the difference.
Do you think he was repentant? Do you think he was sorry for what he had done?
I do. I do think he was. And, I mean, he was in on Tennessee death row than Texas death row, because he could do a job. He had a job. I worked in the laundry. He could earn a little bit of money. He never, ever asked us for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And some prisoners do. Some places, they don't have any jobs, like Texas. It was contact visits as well, which made a difference, because in Texas there's no contact visits. You have to speak through a telephone.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, mm-hmm. yes.
So you could give them a hug.
Yes, which is good. I feel like people who can have no contact, it's so sad, really.
Oh, it's terrible. It's just like putting people in solitary it's mm-hmm. the same thing as putting someone in solitary confinement. There have been so many rulings that it's cruel and unusual punishment, which is against the Constitution, and it's against international law, but, you know, no contact visits, isolating people in cells for 23 or in supermaxes, like, indefinitely is a form of torture.
It is, and it causes mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really terrible. So you and your sister Jean knew David for 25 of the 34 years he was on death row.
Yes.
And when he was executed, he was 61 years old. And when he was first sentenced, he was about 24 when he committed his crime,
yes.
and 27 when he was sentenced. So mm. he was on death row basically his entire life.
Yeah, he was the longest serving person in that prison in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't even gotten to some of the other stuff I want to talk to you about, Mary, with regards to the different prisons that you and your sister visit around the country, and talking a little bit more about David. Is there a chance you'd be able to come back to the show next week so we can kind of finish our interview?
Yes, okay. Of course.
Well, that would be wonderful. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline here on KBOO Community Radio. We're talking with Mary Nordkavelli and Jean Richardson, and we will be back next week to finish our conversation with Mary. We're talking to Mary right now from the United Kingdom, where it's 2:00 in the morning. So I really appreciate you spending some time sharing your stories of David with some of our listeners, Mary. I hope that David's life is a blessed memory. I mean, I hope that in spite of what he did, that some of the stories that you're able to share of his life and your experiences with visiting him will help people see that, you know, people who are on death row are human beings, just like all of us.
Yes.
They made a terrible mistake, but mm-hmm. It may not be the best idea to just kill them because they made a terrible mistake. There's other ways to deal with issues of crime than just murdering people because they murdered someone.
Person is not just the worst thing that they've ever done.
Exactly. Well, you've been listening to Prison Pipeline, Mary. Thank you so much for your time, and we will talk to you next week to finish our conversation on the life of David Miller, and also talk some more about your experiences here in the U.S. and maybe do some comparing and contrasting of our justice systems in England and the United States.
Okay.
So thank you so much, and have a good evening. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. We play every Monday at 6:30 p.m. here on KBOO Community Radio, and we will see you next week. Have a good night.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, Don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the screening of the documentary film Big Money Agenda on Sunday, February 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Big Money Agenda explores the effects of money in politics, Citizens United, as well as solutions to the issues of money in politics that's preventing real change. There will also be a discussion after the film. Again, that's the screening of the documentary film Big Money Agenda on Sunday, February 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium in Portland. Films showing this year include Mr. Soul, The Ballad of Shirley Collins, Solo, The Evolution of the One-Man Band, Gospel According to Al Green, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community.